We are studying Parashat Hukat. The beginning of our parasha introduces the law of the Para Aduma, the red heifer. Zot Hukat HaTorah Asher Siva Hashem Lemor. The way the Torah introduces it to us is by saying Zot Hukat HaTorah. This is the law of the Torah. Of course, the Hachamim right away question, or the Haim HaKadosh says, why would the Torah introduce a specific law like Para Aduma with such a general terminology? This is the law of the Torah. It's not the law of the Torah, it's the law of the Para. Or if you want to be a little more general, you could say Zot Chukat HaTumah. This is the law regarding if somebody becomes contaminated, how you ritually purify him by taking the Para Aduma and you burn its ashes and you sprinkle it on him. But what does it mean when it says Zot Chukat HaTorah, that this is the law of the Torah? So the Or HaHaim HaKadosh, as well as the other Mefarshim, all point out that the Para Aduma is the quintessential hook, which is, it's a law that defies logic, that we really cannot interpret it or give an interpretation or an explanation to it. It's beyond our scope of thinking. Even Shlomo HaMelech, the wisest of all men, when he attempted to give an interpretation to Para Aduma, he writes in his book Kohelet, Amok, Amok, En Mevin. It's very deep, beyond comprehension. And then he says, V'hide choka mimeni. He says, it's beyond me. Now, if that's Shlomo HaMelech talking, who was the wisest of all men, now that's not like some second grader saying that Einstein's theory of relativity is beyond him. That doesn't mean too much to us. But if a nuclear scientist comes along and says that, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity is deep and beyond us, then already that means something. When an Amaharis comes along and says that this piece of Gemara is perplexing to me, you know, it's a big deal. Everything's perplexing to him. You know, his remembering his phone number is perplexing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he doesn't really make a statement. However, when the wisest of all men, Shlomo HaMelech, tells us that the Para Aduma was difficult for him, that already tells us how much profundity the halakha has. But again, the question is, why then give a general terminology, Zot Chukat HaTorah, as opposed to Zot Chukat HaPara? So the Mefarshim explain that the lesson of Para Aduma is that in essence the entire Torah must be obeyed as a chuk, as a law without reason, even though it has reason. Many of our laws can be explained logically with rationale. Those laws are called the Mishpatim. However, at the end of the day, one must fulfill the Torah as if it's without rationale. Because once one starts to begin to add his reasoning, then already this is fraught with great hazard. I'll give you an example. Somebody might come along and say that the reason why the Torah forbids us from eating pork is because it leads to trichinosis, and it's an issue of bacteria, and therefore the Torah, which is concerned about our health, forbids us to eat this over here. Now, if, let's say, you know, the doctors would come out and, you know, you'd have a report from the New England Journal of Medicine where they tell you that they've conquered the hygienic factors, let's say, you know, there's no issue anymore of trichinosis, so you come along and say, okay, there you go, now that'll be permissible. So it's very dangerous to give reasons for the laws of the Torah, because when those reasons apply no more, then already the Torah becomes limited. For that matter, even on the social laws, Torah says it's forbidden to murder. Now, even though we can all probably give our own reasons why it's forbidden to murder somebody. However, once you start giving logic to it, then already you open yourself up for exceptions. For example, in our country today, euthanasia is a form of legalized murder in some states.
We've heard about cases of doctor-assisted suicide. Now, that can only come about because she gave an interpretation to why murder is forbidden. Either you explained it is because you're taking away quality of life of somebody. Oh, so you defined it. Now, once already you bring in the quality of life issue, so if there's an 85-year-old man that's suffering and he has no quality of life and he can't eat on his own and he can't relieve himself on his own and he needs nurses to take care of him, so what type of quality of life does this person have? And therefore it's not considered murder. And therefore it becomes legal. That's the same thing where abortion would become permissible. You know, murder only means where you're murdering somebody that's already, that has functionality to it. An embryo in the womb has no function to it. It's in the womb yet, it hasn't come out yet, and it cannot enjoy the regular pleasures of life. So that's not considered murder again. So you see, once you start giving definition, that already always becomes exceptions. The communists gave interpretations to why thievery is forbidden. Thievery is forbidden because it's not fair. But if we can figure out a thievery that is fair, then it'll be okay. Now that's Robin Hood, where you steal from the rich and give to the poor. Now that makes sense. That's fair. The rich guy has enough money anyway, even after you steal from him. And now, equality of the dispersion of wealth. Give it to the poor guy. Give the guy life as well. And that was communism. Socialism is what? Taking the money from the rich and giving it out, dividing it equally to everybody else. So that already legalized theft. So you have to be very, very careful to start giving interpretation and reasons, even for the laws that we do understand. Kibud Avayim would be another example. When the Torah tells us to honor our parents, obviously that makes much sense to most decent people, either from a standpoint of Hakarat HaTov, of gratitude for what they did for us, or for the fact that they're older than us. Different reasons why we have to respect that. Well, it's for all that they...
But the rabbis do give interpretation.
Of course. Now, I'm going to explain to you the interpretation that they give. As a matter of fact, there was a book written...
That's more than the whole of the Parah Adamah.
That's good. Because those Parashiyot talk about human nature.
Yeah.
And human nature is just as complex and just as deep.
Right.
You know, every human being is a separate Torah on his own. I don't argue with you. But I'm explaining it to you as well. Kibud Avayim cannot be limited to an interpretation of respect, because then you'll always find excuses why your parents don't deserve respect. You know, the Gemara tells an episode of a fellow that his father took his wallet and threw it into the river. And the Gemara says that still that man was obligated to respect his father. Now, if you're saying, what do you mean? I only have to respect my father because he gives me, because he takes care of me, because he does for me. But what he doesn't do for me, on the contrary, when he causes me damage, so all bets are off. You take your father, you throw him in the ocean after the wallet. So therefore, the Torah comes along and says, Zot Hukat HaTorah. This is the hawk, not of Parah Adumah, not of the laws of Tumah. This should be a mindset that a Jew has to have throughout the Torah, that the reasons do not bring the law. So then why do the rabbis give reasons then? As a matter of fact, there's a book called Sefer HaChinuch, which was written by the Rabbi Aaron HaLevi, which was one of the Rishonim, which he dedicated an entire Sefer to giving the rationale behind the 613 mitzvot. And in every mitzvah he writes, Mishor Sheh mitzvah, from the roots of the mitzvah, he gives you a logical explanation to it. So I heard from one of the rabbis, the reasons of the mitzvot in Hebrew are called ta'ameh mitzvot. Ta'am also could be interpreted to a taste. Ta'am is a taste. Which means the rabbis wanted to make the mitzvot palatable to a person. Which means if a person eats something, food provides nutrition whether it has taste or not. Which means even if a person is being sustained intravenously, where he doesn't taste his food, bottom line of existence. So why then do they go out of their way to put spices in food and different type of seasonings and condiments? Because it gives a better taste. It's much easier and more pleasurable to eat a food that has ta'am instead of eating bland food that is tasteless. That's the same logic when the rabbis gave us reasons for the mitzvot. They weren't giving us necessarily reasons, but they were giving us ta'am. They were adding flavor to the mitzvot. Which it's much easier for a person to fulfill a law that he has some basic understanding. Which means that he has some logic. Even if he admits to himself that it's going to give me nutrition whether I understand it or not. It's going to spiritually sustain my soul whether I understand it or not. But to give it a person an encouragement, it's always easier to eat food with salt and seasoning than to eat it without. The same thing with religion. They once asked the Hafez Chaim. They said, it's said that whoever ate the man enjoyed one of the miracles of the man, that whatever he was thinking about, that's what it tasted like. You know, if a guy was thinking about a steak, so it tasted like a steak. If a guy was thinking about a piece of fish, it tasted like a piece of fish. No, except for these certain exceptions that the Torah tells us. Most things what you thought about, the man tasted like. So they asked the Hafez Chaim, let's say you weren't thinking about anything. Well, the guy's always thinking about something when he's eating, you know, most of the people are eating, they're not thinking about anything. So the Hafez Chaim says, then the man was tasteless. And he says, that's the same thing about religion. You know, when religion is done without an understanding, without reasons, without knowing the why of it, then already religion becomes like very, very, you know, tasteless man. And it's very, very, it becomes very difficult after a while. It becomes monotonous. It becomes hard to swallow. And therefore the Hafez Chaim said it's important to delve into the mitzvot, to know exactly what you're doing, what the source is, what the reason is. But at the end of the day, the mitzvot must be fulfilled regardless. And I have a proof to this. I don't think this is my proof. I think the Brisker Rav brought this proof. The reason that we eat matzah on Pesach, even a kindergarten student would be able to answer that. Because when we came out of Egypt, and there wasn't enough time for us to leave, and we were rushing, and we had some dough on our shoulders, and it was sun-baked, and it didn't have time to rise, and therefore we ate matzot. So to commemorate the Exodus, we eat matzot. Only question is, then how come when the guests came to visit Abraham Abinu, he served them matzot? And then Rashi tells us, Pesach haya, was Pesach. What are you talking? Abraham, there's no purpose to eat matzot if we didn't get out of Egypt yet. So what are you commemorating? There's nothing to commemorate. Or we read the story of when Yitzhak Abinu wanted to bless his children. So he tells Esav to go out to the field and bring back some game. And it says, bring back two goats. So the rabbis say, you know, Yitzhak Abinu is a tzaddik, and how much can a man eat? Two goats? What was he thinking? So the Gemara says, no, it was Erev Pesach. And therefore he told his son, go bring one for Korban Pesach and one for Korban Chagigah. Now, Korban Pesach, what Korban Pesach? We didn't enjoy the Exodus yet to bring a Korban Pesach. And it seems that our forefathers were still fulfilling that law. So what does that tell you? That tells you the law has meaning on its own. Which is the reason why you have to eat matzah is because you have to eat matzah. Happened to be to make it easier for us to swallow the matzah and Pesach, God engineered it that when we left Egypt, matzah will have a role in it. Just so when it comes to the night of Pesach, you can say, oh, this is a commemorative event. But even if we never left Egypt, we still have to eat matzah, but then it becomes much harder. It's hard to swallow as it is, but it becomes much harder to swallow if you... Rabbi, what are we doing? Just eat this here. What do we need? You didn't eat enough. You know, you didn't lean, do it again. What are you talking about? What are we doing over here? Right, just do it. Oh. So therefore, to benefit the observant Jew, the Torah based a lot of its laws in our history. So therefore, it becomes more palatable. And that's why it's called Ta'ameh HaMitzvot. Ta'am, not the reasons of the mitzvot, the flavor of the mitzvot. The ta'am is the seasoning of the mitzvot that makes it, it generates an appetite at least. You know, it makes it easier to fulfill. And that's why it says, Zot Chukat HaTorah. It should be pointed out that Rashi does bring down that the Parah Adumah law does serve as an atonement for the Egel. The famous Mashal that Rabbi Moshe Darshan brings down of a child that somehow crawled his way into the palace, and now as he's in front of the king, he his pamper it seems was loose, And what ended up happening, he dirtied the marble floors of the king. Now the king is all angry. So the king says, let the mother of this kid come and clean up its mess.
Where is the mother?
Where is the mother? That's the question. Where's the mother? The mother's outside. So the king says, where's the mother? So the king, so the Rabbi Moshe Darshan says, Rabbi Moshe Darshan says that the Egel, which is the little cow, committed a great stain or made a great stain on the Jewish nation when we worship the Egel, the Avodah Zarah. Mm-hmm. So God says, let the mother of the Egel, let the para, let the cow come and clean up the mess of the Egel. Now, what does that mean? I thought we just said there's no reason, there's no logic, there's no understanding. Now already we're understanding something, that this is a kapara for the Egel. And what does this got to do with kapara for the Egel? It's a very, very seemingly childish mashal over here. You know, just because the para is the mother of the calf, so therefore what? That's kapara? Let the mother come clean it up? How? So explanation is like this. The Jewish people in that generation that worshipped the Egel, What was their sin exactly? Well, you say the sin was Avodah Zarah. You know, they took an image of gold that they fashioned with their own hands and they worshipped it. They said, El Eloheche Yisrael. But the question is, how did they get to that? We know the end result. How did they get to such a sin? So the explanation is that they thought to themselves, Moshe Rabbeinu was gone for 40 days and 40 nights. He promised that he's going to come back on the 40th day. He's not here. So they started to use their logic and say, there's no way he's coming back. How is he able to live 40 days and 40 nights in heaven without eating or drinking? It's for certain that Moshe Rabbeinu died. So they started to employ their logic. And they started to say, it's impossible. It defies any normalcy and any intelligent thinking that a man can go for 40 days and 40 nights and then return. And then when they saw that he was delayed, at least according to their calculations, they said, you see, we were right, impossible, he's not coming back. And what ended up happening? From that, it ended up spinning out of control into the Egel. And therefore God says, what got you into the mess of the Egel is you started to apply logic to a law that Moshe Rabbeinu told you. Moshe says, I'm coming back. How am I coming back? How is it possible? Now, if you don't understand, I'm telling you, I'm coming back, I'm coming back. Once they started to use their brains and think it out, so that caused them to make the sin of the Egel. So God says, what's the kapara? The kapara for such a sin is the paradigm hook. Now I'm going to give you a law that's going to defy logic. You're not going to understand it. It doesn't make any sense. And what are you going to have to do? You're going to have to follow it. So that, using your brain to outsmart the law, is atoned by getting a law that defies the logic. Now by keeping this mitzvah, it'll train the Jew that even in face of a difficult concept, that he must follow it anyway. Hence, there's a direct relationship between the Egel and the Parah Adumah. There is a famous Gemara in Masechet Kiddushin. The Gemara there tells a story of a Gentile by the name of Dama ben Netina. The Gemara says nobody respected his parents like Dama ben Netina. The Gemara tells an episode there of the rabbis that came to visit this fellow. It seems that he had in his possession a very precious stone that the Hachamim needed for the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. You know, there was 12 precious stones, and it seems they were rare. And he had one. How did they know he had one stone? The word got out. So they come to his house and they say, you know, we'll give you an exorbitant amount of money for the stone. And the guy says, you know, I can't sell it to you. What do you mean you can't sell it? We'll give you more money. He says, no, it's not the money issue over here, but it's in my father's vault. And my father's sleeping, and he's sleeping on the key, and I can't wake him up. Mm-hmm. The Gemara says, whoa, what a guy, what a guy, which means for Kibud Avraham, he's willing to, you know, to give up such an opportunity. Now, I have to explain to this Gemara, this is in parentheses. Somebody once asked, and it's a valid question, what type of Kibud Avraham is this over here? Yeah. Which is, wouldn't you want your kid to wake you up, you know, to make a $500,000 or $1 million? What does it mean? What's going on? Kibud Ahiri? He's not a tzaddik. You say the guy's a tipesh. The guy's an imbecile. You know, you have a chance to make sense. So you wake your father. Hey, what are you waking me up for? Dad. Listen, we're making $1 million. Phenomenal. You should have woke me up earlier. Fantastic. Take the key. The explanation is like this. There are certain things that have what we call intrinsic value to them. Which means a precious stone, let's say a diamond is a diamond. And therefore, you could sell it to the Hakamim for the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, or you can go to the diamond market and also get value. Which means it's not like he was selling an item that is worth nothing, but only has value because the rabbis need it or the Kohen needs it. It's not like he was selling a piece of cheese for $1 million. You know, then already he would have woke up his father. Then already Halakha says you wake up your father because you're not going to sell a piece of cheese for $1 million somewhere else. However, in this case over here, he knew if he doesn't sell it to the Hachamim, he could take this diamond or this ruby or whatever it was, go to the jewelry district, and he might not get the exact price because they wouldn't need it, but he can get by. He's not selling it for a quarter. He's going to get fair market value for it. So therefore, in that case, it's kibud avahemera. What are you waking up your father if you can get basically the same money tomorrow from somewhere else? So whatever, you're going to wake up your father to take his sleep? So that's where the kibud avahem comes in. That's halakha. The only issue is the Gemara gives us a PS to the story. PS, the guy the following year in his herd of animals was born to him a para aduma. So now the rabbis come back to him again. And it's okay, now we need the para aduma. And we'll give you, whatever money you want. This is a rare item now. This is an item that only the rabbis need. The green don't have too much value for a red cow, but the hakamim do. Paradumas, the Zohar says there was only 10 paradumas in history. So therefore, this is a real commodity. So they come along and they say, we'll take the paradumah. So the guy says, listen, I'm not going to shake you down. I'm not going to take advantage. Just give me the money that I lost for doing kibud avahem. Just pay me to compensate me for what I lost last year. Give me the same amount of money. What is the number? 800,000 we decided last year for the jewel? Give me 800,000, we'll call it a day. So the Hakamim come on this piece of Gemara and they scrutinize it. You know, they try to analyze exactly, was Dama bin Nitina a perfect person, the way he respected his parents, or even was Dama bin Nitina's respect flawed? And the Hakamim tell us it was a flawed respect. Why? So Rabbi Gifter explained, listen to the terminology he uses the following year. He comes along and tells the rabbis, just give me the money that I lost for respect. Rabbi Gifter says, that's how you look at the mitzvah. You look at it as already a loss, which means, imagine if a daughter has to take her aging mother to the doctor one afternoon. So she gets in the car and she drives her to the city and she sits in the doctor's office the whole day with the money. Could you imagine the value of such a mitzvah? Kibud avahem, you're fulfilling it on the highest level. And then at the end of the day, a friend calls up and says, what'd you do today? Says, well, I wasn't able, I lost out on my card game because I had to take my mother to the hospital, to the doctor. What? You lost out? I could even say such a thing. Is there a comparison between, or a better, a guy that's going to the lottery agent to cash in a $30 million lotto ticket? And on the way there, they tell him, what happened? He says, well, I lost 6 hours of work today to go cash in the ticket. They say, how much money do you make an hour? I make $6 an hour. So you lost $36 because you had to go collect $36? What kind of foolish statement is that? That's like a sort of a loss. It's so diverse. You don't say such a thing like that. Kol sheken when it comes to a mitzvah. You did kibud avahem. Now you come along and you're looking at it in dollars and cents. You come along and say, listen, just compensate me for the loss. It's a loss. You have such a zechut that you didn't wake up your father. It's priceless. There's no value to that. So now already you're measuring. You say, well, I incurred a financial loss cost of the mitzvah. Just compensate me. Rabbi Gifter said, that's already a flawed attitude towards the mitzvah. We don't give price to the mitzvah. We don't look at mitzvot in that sense over there. How much did you lose as a result of the mitzvah? On the contrary, it's the ultimate gain. There could be no downside to a mitzvah where you're able to start saying, well, look what I lost as a result of it. I wasn't able to do this. What are you talking about? You weren't able to do this. You don't understand what that vehem is then. You don't understand the value of it. You don't understand the importance of it. But I heard another explanation which I'd like to share with you. What is an attitude of a person supposed to be after he fulfills a mitzvah? Is a person supposed to relish in the mitzvah that he did and constantly remind himself of the mitzvah and constantly flaunt the fact that he did the mitzvah? Or after a person does the mitzvah, is he supposed to put in the vault and forget about it, so to speak, and next, go forward? You know, some will argue and say that if a person is living in the past, so he'll become complacent. You know, a person starts counting all his chips and seeing all the good things he did, so that already slows him down and weakens his inspiration to do more. But if a person does the mitzvah, next, forget about the mitzvah, go forward. He looks not what he did, but what he still has ahead of him. That was the problem of Dama ben Netina. A year later, and the guy still thinking about the great deed that he did by not waking up his father. And how do we know that it was still on his mind? Because right away the first thing that comes out of his mouth is, he says, oh, here it is, now I can cash in the chip. What do you mean? You still remember? You can move that vayim? Forget about the mitzvot that you did, which means move on. He looked at a mitzvah as a token. And now already he's able to cash it in for another reward. And that's the tefillah that we say in the services on the high holidays. On Yom Kippur we say, Ki zocher kol anishkachot ata. What does that mean? God, you remember everything that we forget. Now, I heard a beautiful explanation to this. This could be referring to a person that does a mitzvah. And after he does the mitzvah, a couple of days later, he forgets that he did the mitzvah. He doesn't even remember. Which is, if you'd ask us, could you remember all the good deeds that you did? We forget. Baruch Hashem, we're so observant, we forget. God says, don't worry. Ki zocher kol anishkachot ata. Anything that you forgot, I remember. But that implies that anything that we remember, God forgets. Which, if a guy's still walking around flaunting the mitzvot that he did, yeah, I did this, chesed, and oh, you still remember it? And then I forget it. God only remembers that which man forgets. Mm-hmm. And the same is true when it comes to sins. Which means, if a person commits iniquity, commits an avon, and after he commits avon, he forgets about it. You know, he moves on to the next sin. God says, oh, you forgot about it? Ki zocher kol anishkachot. I remember all the sins that you forgot. But if the man remembers his sin and is constantly making teshuvah, so you didn't forget it, God forgets it. Ki zocher kol anishkachot. God only remembers the things that we forget, but the thing that we remember, He doesn't. So therefore you see over here an attitude towards the mitzvot. Of course one has to be very excited and very proud to have the zechut to do a mitzvah. But after he does the mitzvah, next, he shouldn't have to broadcast it, he doesn't have to announce it, he doesn't have to have it written about, he doesn't have to have it, you know, spoken about so much. There comes a certain statute of limitation after you do the mitzvah, and you relished it and you enjoyed the excitement of it. Next, move on. Don't, you know, don't overextend the enjoyment of a mitzvah. Take it and do the next one. That was the problem with Dama ben Netina. It's a year later, Dama ben Netina. I was talking about, you did a great thing, you didn't wake up your father. You're still talking about it? Now you're still talking about it, but it must have been on the front of his mind. Because the first thing that comes out of his mouth when the rabbis come along and say, and we did para adama, oh, here it is, here's my opportunity. All right, cash in the chip. What do you mean, chip? What do you remember last year, the rabbi, what are you talking about last year? What was last year? You remember, I didn't wake up my, they forgot about it. And already he's still talking about it. That's already the problem of the Dama ben Netina. But I heard yet a third explanation to this, Gemara, with your permission. It's a little strange. You know, God always has reasons why He rewards people the way He rewards them. Usually it works with the midah keneged midah, measure for measure system. Here, He foregoes a great profit. So how does God reward him? With a para aduma. God could have rewarded him, for that matter, with winning lotto. Mm-hmm. You know, God could have rewarded him with a windfall. The prophet, you know, what does God have to give the guy a para aduma specifically? You know, what's that angle of it? So Rav Chida answers as follows. After Dama ben Etina was willing to forego all that money, in heaven there was a great debate that ensued. The prosecuting angels against the Jewish people came in front of God and said, look what a goy is able to do. Look at a Gentile living in Ashkelon. Look what he's willing to lose for kibud avo. Are there Jews like that? Would a Jew be willing to lose $800,000 for kibud avo? And this story casted the Jewish people in a very negative light. So the defending angels came along and engineered a situation to see if we can undo the prosecution. And what did they do? They gave Dama ben Etina, the same guy, a para aduma. And sure enough, the rabbis come to Dama's house and they tell Dama ben Etina, we're willing to pay $800,000 for the para aduma. So certainly Dama ben Etina was shocked when he heard this. He probably asked the rabbis, what in the world are you going to do with this para aduma? Explain it to me. You know what the rabbis told him?
Yeah.
Can't explain it to you. What? You're willing to pay $800,000 for an item that you cannot give me an explanation what it does? That, well, yeah, it purifies people that got ritually contaminated. How? Wouldn't taking a bath be a better option? Or soaking yourself in an ocean? Wouldn't the world, by sprinkling ashes, how does sprinkling of dirty ash cleanse a person? Rabbis interpret it. Now, what do the rabbis say?
We don't.
Can't understand it, but we're willing to give you $800,000. At that point, the defending angels come to God and say, yes, a Gentile might be willing to lose $800,000 for something he can understand. But a Jew is so obedient that he's willing to spend $800,000 even for something that he cannot contemplate, for something that he cannot perceive. So that already was specifically done by design in order to undo that claim that they had in us in heaven, which is the rabbis, by going and willing to expend that much money, that already casted a very positive light on the Jewish people. Yes, there are people that can only spend money on things that make sense, but the Jew to fulfill the mitzvah, for example, how much money would all of us spend on our tefillin? You really can't give an understanding why the tefillin is supposed to be black. Why not another color? Why do they have to be made out of leather, not formica? Why do they have to be square? Why not round? He said, all these things the Gemara says is halakha l'Moshe Misinai. Why the sheen on the box? Why the dalet on the bag? Why the yud? All these things are just hook. This is the way it's done. But there's not one person that ever goes to the sofer and demands an interpretation when the guy tells him it costs $2,000 for a pair of tefillin. Right away he tells them, is there a better pair? You know, you have a pair that's a little more written by a better sofer. So that's the Jewish logic. We purchase mitzvot even though we might not be able to give an interpretation. That's already a high level. To respect your father, anybody can understand that. But to respect para aduma, that already takes somebody on a higher level. In any event, the parasha continues and goes a little further. Torah tells us towards the middle of the parasha, Perek Yutet Pasuk Yud Dalet, right in the middle of the laws of Tumah V'Tara, Zot HaTorah, Adam Ki Yamut Be'Oher. This is the Torah regarding a person that should die in a tent. The famous Gemara in this piece learns over here not only a law in the laws of Tum'at Met, but the law in how to study Torah. The Gemara says in Gittin, Elu Talmidei Hachamim Shemimitim Atzmam Al Devrei Torah. And the Gemara says in another place in Shabbat Pegimal, En Devrei Torah Mitkayem Ela Bemi Shemimit Atzmo Aleha. Devrei Torah does not perpetuate in a person unless he's willing to die for it. Zot HaTorah. You want to be successful in Torah? Adam Ki Yamut Be'ohim. You must be willing to die. Be oil. What oil? The yeshiva. The oil is the oil of Torah. Be Yaakov, Ishtam, Yosef Oalim. Means a person has to be willing to die. What does that mean? Sacrifice himself until the point of death. So there's a famous interpretation of the Hafez Chaim to explain this. Of course, a person is not supposed to die for anything. Only the three cardinal sins. For every other mitzvah, the haibahim, the Torah says. You must live by the Torah. Torah is a living Torah. And now the Torah tells us when it comes to the Vrei Torah, in the Vrei Torah mitkayim ela b'mi shememit atzmo. How could you learn Torah if you're going to be dead? So the Hafez Chaim explained that there was a fellow that had a retail store, and he started towards the end of his life to get a little more religious, and the rabbi impressed upon him how you have to learn Torah every single day, and it's important, especially now you're getting a little older, you started getting some gray hairs, white hairs, you got to prepare for the future. So instead of opening his store at 9 a.m. like he used to, his class used to go until 10 a.m. So now there's some customer standing at the store at 9 a.m. and there's a line outside the store, and the wife happens to walk by and says, oh, what's going on over here? Where's my husband over here? There's customers at this munat outside the store over here. Someone's got to let him in. So where's my husband? Where is the guy? She finally finds out after a few days that the guy joined the yeshiva and is studying every morning till 10 a.m. So she starts to yell at him, what are you crazy? What are you doing over here? There's customers in the store. You got to come back, open, give us, get the keys, get it open, open the gate. So the fellow said, let me ask you a question. Do you think I'm going to live forever? I'm not going to live forever. What's going to happen after 120 years and I'm in this cemetery dead? And at 9 a.m. there's going to be customers in the store. What are you going to come to my grave and start banging on the grave? Get up, there's customers. There comes a certain time where that's it. I'm not going to be able to come to the store anymore. So the rabbi Hafez Chaim said, when a person's learning Torah, the attitude that he has to have is, at that point that he's learning, he's dead to the world. Which means you have to have the attitude. What if I was, if the person was dead now? Could he go to the store? Could he take a phone call if he's dead? Is he able to interrupt it? Which means that time that you're learning, it's dead time. Then already, you'll be able to succeed. But if a person doesn't have that attitude, there's a million and one interruptions that'll cause the guy not to learn for the hour or two that he allotted to the study. Oh, excuse me, I have to go over here. Excuse me, I have to take care of something. Excuse me, I can't come today. At that point, whatever the hour of the day that you're learning, you're dead. If you're dead, could you do anything? You can do nothing. Zot HaTorah. If you want to succeed into it, Adam Ki Yamut Be'Oyin. He has to have the attitude that he's dead at that moment that he's learning, where he cannot accomplish anything else but what he's doing at that moment. But the Hatam Sofer has a different interpretation to this. We're going to read at the end of the book of Devarim, Chas v'Shalom, the different curses that come on people that do not fulfill the Torah. And one of the curses are, Arur asher lo yakim et devrei Torah zot. Cursed is a person that does not uphold the Torah. So the Gemara says, how does one uphold the Torah? So the Gemara says, even if a person studies, and he learns, and he teaches, but he doesn't rebuke others that are not performing, and therefore he watches the Torah being trampled on, he watches the Torah not being fulfilled, so that is the Kelala Arura Shelo Yakim, meaning you're not causing others to uphold. By watching the Torah being destroyed, that already is part of Arur. Even though yourself, you're religious. Shalom alay nafshi. Your family is religious, you're fulfilling. So the Hatam Sofer says, what does that mean? That the Tamid Chacham has a responsibility, or for that matter, every Jew in his capacity, has a responsibility to rebuke others. But it's not so easy to rebuke others, especially when those others are very influential people and very wealthy people. And therefore, if a leader is going to come against the, you know, the wealth, and to come after the influence, so already he's putting his reputation on the line now. He's putting his career on the line now, because now already these are men of power. So they come along and say, what, you're talking about me? You're referring to me over there? Once one call to the committee, that's it. You're fired. One call to the yeshiva, you have no job anymore. And therefore, a leader is put in a position now where he has an obligation to rebuke, but on the other hand, he's scared. Because he knows if he rebukes, especially people that are men of stature, so therefore he's gonna risk his own career. So the Torah says, Zota Torah Adam ki yamut be'ohel. If a person wants to succeed in upholding the Torah, he has to be willing to die. Meaning, he has to be willing to sacrifice everything that he has. His reputation, his career, his friends, his honor, his perception. In order what? To speak the truth. Once already, a person is not willing to sacrifice his own prestige and honor for the honor of the Torah, then already he's not yet reached the level of Adam Ki Yamut Be'oyed. He has to be willing to sacrifice all in order to stand for the truth. Torah continues. Torah tells us in... Which one will I tell you? Look at Perekhaf Aleph Pasuk Lamed Dalet. Perekhaf Aleph Pasuk Lamed Dalet. Torah tells us over there. You find it myself. Kaf Aleph Lamed Dalet. Aha. 854, right? 854. At the end of Moshe Rabbeinu's life, Moshe Rabbeinu now had to wage war against Og Melech HaBashan. Og was a giant. He was the king of Bashan. Moshe Rabbeinu was scared. He didn't think he would be able to defeat him. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, al tira oto. Don't be scared. So the Mefarshim asked, Moshe Rabbeinu is scared? What's Moshe Rabbeinu scared of? Moshe, you're forgetting you toppled the Egyptian empire? Yeah, in its time, the Egyptian empire was the only superpower in the world. And Moshe Rabbeinu single-handedly went in there, and he brought 10 plagues, 50 plagues on Yam Suf. He was able to take out 3 million people without an army, without weapons, and there was no Egyptians left. Mm-hmm. Now you're worried about fighting one giant. I don't care how big the guy is. I don't care if the guy's as big as the Empire State Building. Bottom line, Moshe Rabbeinu, what are you scared of? God has to come and console him. Don't worry about it. You could do it. So the Mefashim explained, Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't scared of Og's muscles, nor was he scared of his towering height or the thickness of his ankles. What was he scared about? He was scared about one zechut that Og had. And that was many years before he did a favor to Avraham Avinu. When Lot, Avraham's nephew, was taken into captivity in the war of the kings, Og found out about it. So Og did a favor to Avraham. He ran from the war. It says, Vayavua Palit, the refugee from the war, that was Og. He ran to Avraham's house and said, Avraham, I have information that I think you'd be concerned about. Avraham says, yeah, but what is it? He says, your nephew Lot is in danger. He's in mortal danger. Avraham says, what? You mean you came from the war? You went out of your way to come tell me that my... You don't have to do that over there. You're not obligated to tell me this over here. Or to scale him, it's what? It's definitely information that I wanted to know. And I appreciate that you told me. And it says Avraham mustered up his own army. And he threw himself into the war. And eventually saved Lot. So now that was a big chesed. And that was a great zechut Og did for Avraham. Now Moshe Rabbeinu knows value. Moshe Rabbeinu says, that zechut might stand for him. Now obviously we see it did stand for him, because
he loved it.
It says Og lived already from the times of Noah. Now from Noah to Avraham was 10 generations. From Avraham to Moshe was another 10 generations. So this man already lived 20 generations. So the guy lived like 2,000 years. There's nobody lived like this guy. So you see the zechut that he had was playing for him. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, I'm scared. Maybe this guy's one zechut is going to protect him. So God tells him, don't worry. Al tira oto. He ran out. You know, we cashed him out already. But the only hadush over here is that there's one caveat to this story. Og was not the most L'shem Shamayim guy when he did that chesed. She says, he really wasn't the nice guy that we think he was. Went out of his way. Avraham, Chesed. It says, Lord, Og had ulterior motives over here. His ulterior motives were that Avraham, knowing Avraham's character, is going to throw himself into the war to try to save his nephew. There's no way Avraham's going to beat the five kings. 318 soldiers against, you know, five armies. So he says, for sure Avraham's going to die. Sarah now will be available and I'll marry her. So this was all about Og really satisfying himself. Which is, he wasn't doing chesed over here. He was already thinking about marrying the most beautiful woman in the world. So how is he going to get to Sarah? He's got to first kill the husband. So how does he kill the husband? Just send him to war. Let him go, kill himself during the war over there. And he does it under the guise of Mr. Nice Guy. Yeah, oh, Lot. Yeah, Hazit, Lot. You know, I'm worried about Lot. Well, you care about Lot. Who cares about Lot? But what do you see from over here? A fantastic concept. That you're right. Ulterior motives. Not l'shem shamayim. Intent was very, very sour. But still what? Bottom line, did he help Avraham?
Yes.
Bottom line, did he do a chesed? From here you see the power of a mitzvah. Even if it's done for the wrong intention, when you do chesed, when you help somebody, what's the difference? Bottom line, did the guy get helped? So what do I care if when you gave the money to the poor guy, you had 16 ulterior motives? Bottom line, now the poor guy can eat lunch. Bottom line, now he can go home and buy clothes for his family. Did you help the guy at the end of the day? You helped him. God rewards for the chesed, even if it's done for the wrong intention. Now, we could draw a kal vachomer from this. Imagine if you do a mitzvah, l'shem shamayim, for the right intention, which means, look at the mitzvah of charity. The Torah tells us that if a farmer is in the field, and he's cutting his wheat, and he forgets a bundle of wheat in the field, he forgets a bundle. He was planning on picking it up. So he takes three steps. He says, oh, I forgot a bundle behind me. So now he's got to leave it there. Now, this guy, if you ask him, do you want to give that bundle to the Aniim? No, I don't want to. I forgot it. I want to go back and get it. You can't get it. If a guy forgets a bundle, Torah says it's a mitzvah, and you get reward. Then the Rashi brings that even a step further. Let's say a guy's walking in the street, and he has a hole in his pocket. Nekabim, nekabim, halunim, halunim. And all his money falls out of his pocket, and there's a poor guy behind him trailing him, and he's picking up all the dollar bills. And the poor guy goes home and says, boy, hi, come my family. I hit a lottery today. Let's go make a party. Now, bottom line, who paid for this party? Who's the baal habayit? The rich guy. Meanwhile, the rich guy came home yelling at his wife, what kind of pants she gave me over here? This holds it. I lost all my money. The Gemara says that man will get credit for feeding the poor family. What do you mean? Not only the guy is upset about it, the guy's cursing his wife because he lost all his money. Bottom line, with all your intentions or lack of intention therein, bottom line, you paid lunch for a poor family. That's what I was coming to tell you. The power of a mitzvah is great. Chesed, this is talking about. Even if it's done, shelo l'shem shamayim. Imagine a guy now goes and gives charity, whether it's to an institution or whether it's to an individual that needs it, and he gives it with the right intent. If that protected Og for 2,000 years, to the extent where Moshe Rabbeinu was scared, and that was a chesed that was tainted, imagine a chesed that's pure, how much that will protect the person. But I'll just conclude with one last idea. And I'll let you go. I saw a midrash that gives us where did Og get his name from. It's not the most common name. We don't see too many people with the name O.G. Og.
Plus, what you have is Oz.
Yeah, you have Oz, but not Og.
Right.
So the explanation I heard from the midrash is like this. It says that Og comes from the word uga. Uga's cake. Unless he liked to eat cake, or he had a factory. What does this mean over here? You could call him Og or uga. That moment when he came to Avraham Avinu, it says Avraham Avinu, it was Pesach. And Avraham Avinu was eating matzot. How do you call matzot in Hebrew? The Torah says ugot matzot. Ugot matzot means matzah cakes. That's what the Torah calls it. So because when he came to Avraham's house, Avraham was eating ugot matzot, so it worked out. You know, the God had it be when he was born that his mother called him a hog, because he knew that, that's all for that situation. Now, if Avraham was eating a frankfurter, they would have called him, Frank. They would have called him, a piece of cake over there, so they call him a hog. That doesn't make sense over here. So explanation is like this. What makes a matzah kasher l'Pesach? You tell me, well, very simple. You take yeast. You take flour, and water. You take water, 18 minutes, put in the oven, and there you go. No, there's three ingredients in matzah. There's flour, water, and kavana. You have to have intent. If you ever went to a matzah bakery, every time they do another one of the processes of baking the matzah, l'shem matzat mitzvah, which means you have to have intent that you're making the matzah for Pesach, for the mitzvah of matzah. Which means if, let's say, they went through a run of baking matzot, and after they finished the 18-minute round, they said, oh, did anybody have any kavanah over here? This is for Pesach, for matzah? No. This matzah cannot be used on Leila Seder. You can eat it after the holiday. But for the Seder itself, you can eat it on the rest of the holiday even. But for the Leila Seder, for the mitzvah, it needs kavanah. Therefore, they must constantly say, there's a mashgiach walking around. Don't forget, l'shem matzat mitzvah, l'shem matzat, say it, repeat it, there's signs all over the place. L'shem matzat mitzvah, before they put it in the oven. L'shem matzat mitzvah. So you have two pieces of matzah in front of you. One becomes usable for a mitzvah, and one becomes plain, regular matzah. And what makes all the difference in the world? Kavanah. And that's what they were trying to hint to Og over here. Which means you have two guys that do chesed. Two guys do a kind act. Both get credit. Both are laudable. Both are praiseworthy. But one is on a different level. One mitzvah is already eternal. And one is limited. And what makes the difference between the two chasadim? One guy had intent, l'shem shamayim, l'shem Hashem, and one other guy didn't have the right intention. And that's why they call Og. What do they call him? They call him Og, which means a cake. Which means he wasn't called Ugot Matzot. A matzah without kavanah is a cake. It's just an ugat, another piece of cake. And then when they were telling him, Og, that was your problem. Jeez, you're going to get credit. We're going to give you credit because Bama did it. It's about what? It's an ugah. It's a cake without intention. It's a matzah without intention. A matzah without intention has limited value. Oh, and that's, if he would have had kavanah, then you know what God would have told Moshe? Be scared. Be scared of him, by the way. Tira oto. Leave Og alone. Don't go after him. But because he didn't do it, because that was Og's day. He was Og. He was a piece of cake. He wasn't Lashem Shamayim. And therefore, eventually, the mitzvah ran out. Eventually the mitzvah had its limitations, and therefore Moshe Rabbeinu was able to subdue it. Amen. 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 Amen.